Sheffield Live, made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel and Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel and Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel and Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Poetry in motion. Turn a tender eyes to me. Stainless in the ocean. Sweet as any harmony. But you blinded me with silence.
She blinded me with silence.
Good morning. Welcome morning. To the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 until 12. You've got Julie and Paul live in the studio. We'll be talking to our PG later in this hour. And we've also got our guest speaker, Dr. Ogo Osamor. Yes. If you tuned in about this time last month, you'd have heard him talking about air quality monitoring, why we do it and how we do it. Well, he's going to be talking about air quality modelling, even more exciting. And I should know because I used to be involved in air quality. Before we go any further, Yorkshire Photographic Unit exhibition is still on at Danham Gallery Library Museum in Doncaster. It runs until the 5th of June. Go and check it out because it's got loads of great photos, including some from Sheffield Photographic Society. Also, a shout out for Mexborough and Swinton Astronomical Society. They seem to be everywhere these days. That's msas.org.uk. They're going to be at Wentworth Village Day in Rotherham on Sunday the 6th of July from 10 until 4. It's all to do with Wentworth Village Community Association celebrating local area with lots of varied local stallholders on Wentworth Village Fields and Mexborough Swinton Astronomical Society. They'll have a stall with safe filtered telescopes for you to use so you can view the sun safely. Hopefully, all good stuff.
Hopefully it will be out.
Yeah, indeed. Elsewhere in science news this week, Paul?
Yes, a high seas treaty enabling new protections for two-thirds of ocean beyond national limits should come into force next year, amid warnings from Sir David Attenborough and Prince William about the threat from overfishing and climate change. The treaty will for the first time allow for the creation of marine parks in international waters. Experts deem it vital for safeguarding fish, whales and other marine life. The treaty was agreed 2 years ago but stalled after only 32 nations ratified it. However, 55 countries have now either ratified or started the process of ratification.
And Britain's sunniest ever spring has generated record solar power, 7.6 terawatt hours of electricity over the first 5 months of this year. And that's and according to the Met Office, we have had 43% more sunshine than average for the season, the most since modern records began 100 115 years ago, but is that all good news? Well,
our sunny spring has not been good news for everyone, though. Farmers in the UK are now facing a disastrous harvest, according to analysis from the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit, which estimates that the production of wheat, barley, oats and oilseed rape could once again be close to all-time lows this year. This follows the third worst harvest on record in 2024 after severe rainfall.
But on a happier note, playing classical music to plants could boost their growth, and that's according to a study published in the journal Evolutionary Studies in Imaginative Culture. According to research from a team of crop scientists and an Oxford psychologist, plants played a series of Bach concertos. As they grew, ended up heavier and leafier, but plants exposed to rock music grew more poorly. What an interesting article. Just tuned in, of course, listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. I'm going to talk about the new space race now. I saw this article in the press a couple of weeks ago now, and I thought it's fascinating. So it's titled The New Space Race, and it says space used to be the domain of two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. However, now, 53 years after man last stood on the moon, a new space race is otting up. The US, the United States, NASA is going back to the moon next spring. Four astronauts, three Americans and one Canadian will orbit the moon on the Artemis 2 mission. And in mid-2027, Artemis 3 is due to reach the lunar surface. A series of moon missions will follow up to Artemis X or 10 in 2035. The United States also has its eyes on Mars with $1 billion a year budgeted towards sending humans to the red planet, with tentative plans for an unmanned mission as soon as next year. So commercial organizations are increasingly involved. Elon Musk's SpaceX and Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin are building moon landers and cargo vehicles. The rocket that will launch Artemis 2 is being built by Boeing and United Launch Alliance. And Lockheed Martin makes the Orion spacecraft, and that will orbit the moon. So Intuitive Machines, based in Houston, has sent two unmanned landers to the moon, but both tipped over on impact. So when we come to Europe in terms of the new space race, the European Space Agency, or the ESA, has built key parts of the spacecraft to be used in NASA's Artemis program. In return, European Space Agency astronauts will get three places on later Artemis missions. However, Trump's budget cuts may scupper this, as NASA is looking to use alternative spacecraft. Nevertheless, the European Space Agency remains key in NASA's ambitions. The European Space Agency also has its own goals. Its unmanned JUICE mission is heading for the moons of Jupiter, searching for life. And the British-built Rosalind Franklin rover will set off for Mars in 2028. So what about Japan? Well, JAXA has two seats reserved on Artemis missions in return for providing a pressurized lunar rover. It lands its own unmanned spacecraft on the moon in 2024, touching down within 10 meters of its target. And when we look at India, the other week, Shubhansu Shukla, 39, will become the first Indian, or did become the first Indian astronaut to visit the International Space Station, along with two European astronauts and one American, on a private mission put on by Axiom. In 2027, Shukla will be one of four Indian astronauts to blast into orbit in the country's first manned space flight. India has already sent spacecraft to the moon's surface and to the orbit of Mars. Well, what about China then? Well, China has had its own space station in orbit since 2021, and unsurprisingly has serious lunar ambitions, having sent several robotic craft to the surface. It plans to send a manned mission to the moon by 2030 and ultimately build a permanent base there. All interesting stuff. We're going to finish with Russia. Roscosmos has worked with the West for years, but that partnership is likely to end when the International Space Station is decommissioned in the early 2030s. Russia has its own ambitions, having tried and failed to send its Luna 25 craft to the moon in 2023. This is not just about the prestige of the country and the achievement of some geopolitical goals, said Yuri Borisov, then the Russian space chief, soon after the craft was lost. This is about ensuring defensive capabilities and achieving technological sovereignty. Ooh, interesting, eh? The race for the development of the natural resources of the moon has begun. So that's what it's all about, this new space race. They're after the natural resources on the moon. Here we go. Great track there. Spaceman by Babylon Zoo. Can you believe that was 1996? Ouch. Of course, listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. And we should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Oh, I've remembered to plug you in. It's always a good idea. You're like an electric vehicle.
Excellent stuff. And somebody switched the sun on as well today.
I know. Well, we thought it was going to rain. Who knows? But we need the rain, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
So what's caught your eye then in the science news this week?
A couple of little things on space. I think one is the news from the International Space Station, ISS, that they've got another small leak, but not much detail coming out about it at the moment. So I don't know whether they'd be chewing gum and trying to stick it into a leak or whatever, but a small leak there, and obviously ISS is coming to the end of its functioning life sort of span. So I think it's already surpassed what it was originally intended. So that was an interesting thing. And also, we talked about the solar probe that was launched this year. And it's been sending back previously unseen images of the South Pole of the sun.
Yes, I saw that as well. Yeah, it was a very interesting article, wasn't it, or newscast?
It is, and it's an interesting probe, I think. You know, it's designed to withstand the temperatures to be able to do the work that it's doing at the moment, because obviously the closer you get to the sun, the warmer it gets. So interesting sort of developments, I think, and sort of looking at in the news from last week, I think I mentioned about the fusion reactors that are in development, and the government put several billions into funding three. One that I talked about in Nottinghamshire, the Yorkshire one, another one. That they're going to put money into trying to develop fusion. But on the local front, the University of Sheffield, the Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre, their partner Rolls-Royce SMR, have been chosen to build the next generation of nuclear power plants. That's the small-scale plants, I believe, that develop out of the things that they use to power nuclear submarines.
Yes, yeah, small modular reactors. I saw that as well, Paul.
Yeah, so I think that's an interesting development, because I think there's this thing about the renewables that it needs a base load, they call it, of electricity produced not in the same way, so it's not wind or solar power, just because they can be lost if there's no wind and if there's no sunshine.
Yeah, that sounds like England, doesn't it? Well, it's funny, because I was going to touch on that, because I saw that article. There was loads in the news this week, but they call them mini nukes.
That's right,
yeah. Which I thought was an interesting one. And it also said that if, in simple terms, think of how they do it is they take atoms of nuclear fuel and split them, releasing a large amount of heat that is then used to heat water, which in turn drives a turbine. So basically, one article I read said it's like they're like giant nuclear kettles, if you can get your head around that. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it's the basis of most of the sort of power generation. It used to be steam production through coal.
Yeah,
and then through other things, and I say the areas they're looking to develop, I think, in Nottinghamshire used to be it was earmarked as biomass, burning compressed wood pellets, and then they started to worry about the long-term viability of that. So I think that's why they're moving towards fusion, but it's that search for clean, cheap energy. And with events in the last couple of days, we're facing yet another sort of price leapfrog because of the problems with potentially oil.
Yeah, it's a tricky issue. And they're saying that the small modular reactors are quicker to build, and you can technically, I guess, have them everywhere, and they're very efficient. And the government's saying, its provisional figures were 14% of the UK's electricity generation last year was from nuclear power anyway.
Yes, it is. And don't forget, we pipe electricity from France, which has got a massive investment in nuclear power. So I think we're getting interconnecting cables with other countries where, depending on, because we get the hour difference, summertime time and things, you can shift the peak demand. So if we've experienced our peak demand, somewhere else will be starting there.
Yeah,
so
interesting.
Switch that generation across between countries. So it's interesting, I think. News again that they're going to invest again in heat source pumps. And as we mentioned last time, I think there's questions about the efficiency of those. so I think there's a big push now again to start reinvesting in insulation and schemes where you can insulate homes, because I think they're pretty good. It's just they don't generate high heat because they're extracting it from the environment, from the ground. So some work on the technical side of those, but also the problems that you've got with them if you start feeding that produced heat into leaky houses.
Yeah.
So interesting stuff. So lots of moves that are starting to come out. I think, again, the infrastructure that's needed for carrying that electricity and storing. So there's still a push for things like battery storage and various other things. So there's lots of research going on to do things like sand heat storage. Lots of sort of varieties to see what works and what doesn't. So keep an eye on that.
Interesting, isn't it? And I guess as you sort of alluded to, I also read an article about the nuclear reactors, particularly these new small ones, that you know, the general public may be more accepting of nuclear power if it reduces the bills.
Well,
it's an interesting one, isn't it? A carrot and a stick.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we've seen the events in the world. It could be something that's out of our grasp, whereas the small reactors bring it back into our area of control, I guess.
We just need to sort rain out now, Paul. Where's the water going to come from? But that's a whole other story.
Well, I think, there's lots of research going on, and we've talked about it before, about trying to trap it in the uplands rather than letting it slide through. And I'm sure there's got to come some legislation about this thing of hard paving the frontages of your homes and things, because it does nobody any favours to sluice water off your drive and pour it down into a sewage system that can't cope.
It's interesting.
So, we've touched on that, and I thought what I'd do to round off is one of those things that I tried to explain some time ago, but quantum mechanics.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no, Paul, please.
Right, we sat down. It's all right, Paul. We sat down. We've got a cup of tea. No, we haven't.
It's just historically, quantum mechanics turns 100. So it's 100 years since the basic sort of discoveries were made. And it all starts, they say, 100 years ago on a quiet rocky island. A German physicist, Werner Heisenberg, helped to set in motion a series of scientific developments that would touch nearly all of physics, and that's he developed a framework for quantum mechanics. So at that time, it was a really just a loose idea of how to confront some issues that had come out of Einstein's theories and other things. There were some questions still to be answered, and I think we did try to come on to an experiment that was called Schrödinger's cat, and that was a quantum state, or two quantum states, and I think what's happened is that those developments have taken on now, and there's a whole new generation of scientists working on quantum mechanics. So there's a Professor Yu, a Chinese scientist, who's been working on something akin to the Schrödinger experiment, but in using a crystal, a sapphire crystal. And what he's managing to do, because the whole preposition of Schrödinger's cat is that it's in two states, and depending on where you're observing, you don't know which state it is. With this crystal, it's a bit more apparent that you can see the atoms are moving in two directions, which is really strange. So he's looking at that. But again, what we talked about is this synchronicity of the two states. So if you've got a positive state, for just an example here on Earth, then somewhere like going to Mars, you could take the other state, and there is a link between them. So they're working on looking at that for long-distance communication, for instance. So you sort of think, well, if you can read the state here on Earth, you know that the opposite of that is happening at the distant point that's on Mars.
Is this like if there's an equal and opposite reaction type thing, the positive and the negative?
Yeah, there are basically two states, and that's the thing. So, and there's a linkage between those that is very difficult to sort of pin down, but it's there. So a lot of the experimentation is that, and a lot of thought conjectured that maybe some of this was the idea for the transporters that they used in Star Trek.
Teleporters.
That actually, I think, in Star Trek became deconstructed matter, transmitted, and then reconstructed.
And all being reconstructed correctly.
Yeah.
On the other side, which didn't always happen, I don't think.
No, but I think with the two states, the thing is that it's echoed in the distant site from the local site, and vice versa. So exactly the same thing at the same time is happening, which is the kind of mind-bending thing.
I'm pretty sure somebody told me about Schrodinger's cat. Is it to do with a box?
Yeah, basically you've got a sealed box with a cat inside.
And is it in there? Does it exist or doesn't exist?
Something. There's that, but also the question is the cat alive or dead? Well, you can't tell because it's a sealed box.
Yeah.
So basically, that sort of brings you into that two states, two possible states there. But how do you prove it? And that's where a lot of research is going in.
I know. I believe it or not, I had a very in-depth conversation back in about 2012 with a Turkish lad called Serkan Tuncay, who was studying quantum mechanics, and he described that, and I was like, what?
He was a barman,
but you know, he was studying, and incredible stuff.
A lot of physicists do ordinary things on the day.
But it was astonishing, and there were people sat round. It's not like we'd had loads to drink, you know, it was nothing like that. And people were sat round thinking, what on earth is this conversation? But that's why when you mentioned it, I thought, I know what that is.
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing. I think it's one of those, great thing about Einstein was he sat and thought about issues and then worked towards understanding how things came about.
Yeah.
And I say quantum physics kind of goes past the level that he got to into a different dimension. And, it's really quite interesting that you've got two states that happen simultaneously but can be drawn apart by huge distances and still occur. trying to see how that linkage is made.
Is it also about people who say if you walk through a wall, or you try to walk through a wall, if you did it enough times, eventually you would go through it, or something.
I think that's the usual thing about any sort of development idea, is that if you keep bashing away at it, eventually you'll get there. Is the sort of brute force theory, I guess, for doing things. This is the thing, is you don't need to go through the wall with the two states, because the opposite but very knowable state is the other side of the wall.
I know. Mind-boggling, Paul.
Well, I think it's a good exercise, isn't it, for your Saturday morning, just when you think you're having a quiet time.
Do you know what Paul's just passed me a note and said? Harry Potter, platform 9 3/4.
Yeah,
think about that. How on earth did they manage that? And the invisibility. Was it the invisibility cloak and the cabinet? Yeah. It's all in there.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of things do come through, and say fiction, science fiction, has predicted a lot of things, and I think it's strange, but we're on this old world, and I think they've just decided that under Antarctica, there's a 34 million year old continent.
Oh.
Get digging.
Yeah.
Well, continent, they did move. The continents did move. I mean, once. I think we were below.
Yes.
We were below Africa, I think, or something strange. The current
sort of conjecture is that we were initially just a water-covered planet. And it was when the sort of tectonic plates start moving that we started to develop things. And it starts off, I mean, there's the background of there being an initial continent called Pangaea. And that sort of surfaced from the water and then split and moved to create the continents and countries that we've got now.
Yeah, over million. I mean, it's millions of years, isn't it? It's quite unbelievable, actually.
Well, yeah, and we've said a few things recently. I talked about the current drought problem. Well, we've been sucking water out of the planet to drink, and it's made a noticeable change.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're talking about sort of saving the oceans, and that's. Trying to get people to believe, because I think sometimes if you sat on your little sort of pedalo or your boat and drifting on the ocean, you don't really think about some of the issues that are confronting that sort of environment.
No, it's interesting times ahead. We mentioned that at the top of the show about what will happen, you know, about these treaties to just stop.
Yeah. Well, and we walk around breathing in and extracting what we need from the air, so I'm sure that when Ogo comes along, it'll be an interesting look at how we start to understand that environment.
Well, I know, it's all around us, isn't it? Complicated stuff, all good stuff, all, and we've got a cracking track to play out with, All the Love of the Universe by Santana.
Oh, sounds great.
What more could you ask for off Caravan Sarai? Thanks a lot, Paul. We'll speak to you Monday, Glory Days Rock Show 1-3, all being well.
Cheers.
Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Yeah. Great track there from Santana, All the Love of the Universe. You are, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. We should have Dr. Ogo Osimo on the line. Good morning, August, sir.
Good morning, Julie. How are you today?
Very well. I can't believe a month has passed since you were last on. Time goes fast.
It shows you're having a good time.
It does indeed. Not enough time in the day. Thank you for giving us your time yet again, Ogo. I know you're a busy man.
Thank you, Julie, for giving me the opportunity as well to speak on these matters.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So last month you talked about air quality monitoring and how we do it and why we do it, and today you're going to talk a bit more about that, but also really about air quality modeling and why we do it and how we do it.
That's correct. As you stated already, we actually physically monitor air pollution levels across the city. However, the monitoring we do is limited to a number of locations. Now, how do you know what the level of pollution is at other locations we don't monitor? Is indeed by conducting air dispersion modeling.
Oh, and this was one of your many specialities, I would say, when you were working.
Indeed, yes. And air dispersion modeling really is a process that uses computer software to simulate how pollutants disperse in the atmosphere. And it helps us to potentially understand how air pollution impacts on health and so forth. Now, the dispersion using computer modeling means that we need to give the computer certain information to enable the mathematical processing the computer does to be able to tell us what we're likely to find in terms of pollutant concentrations at locations where we don't monitor.
Yeah, because in Sheffield, to be fair, I think we've got very, very wide coverage, haven't we, of air quality monitoring, probably more so than many other cities, I would say.
Indeed, that's correct. But even with the quantity of monitoring we do in Sheffield, there are still many parts of Sheffield where the only way to find out what the level of pollution is at those locations is indeed by using predictive modeling.
Yeah, and it's complicated stuff, isn't it? Yeah.
This is where air dispersion modeling comes in.
Yeah, I recall we used AirViro, a computer package. It's very specialised, called AirViro. I know other places have used other bits, but are you just going to talk about AirViro and how it all works? Because it is complicated stuff.
Yes, it is complicated. I think the beauty about AirViro is that it is a web-based air quality management system, which was developed in Sweden. So that means you can go on holiday, be on the seaside,
and still work.
Exactly. As long as you have connection.
Oh, my word, oh girl.
You should be able to do a dispersion modeling. You should
wherever
be able to
monitor
all your automatic monitoring stations and so forth.
Amazing. Can you remember why Sheffield chose AirViro as opposed to, say, any other software?
At the early stages, when Sheffield took it up, it was because we were approached by Apertum, the company that developed it.
Yeah.
And there were two consultants supplying air dispersion models, including AirVIRO, in fact. But we found out that AirVIRO, you know, offers this, you know, web facility, which means, you know, you don't have to have your have your laptop sitting with you in terms of where you are and so forth to be able to do your physical, the monitoring, modeling physically. So even though you have your laptop, the software does not have to sit with you, you know, in the laptop.
I understand.
You can access,
yeah,
on the web.
Yes. Yeah. So, very, yeah, interesting. So I guess,
but also, it's, yeah, a very qualitative. It's amazing what AirVIRO does in terms of. Is very good, you know, in terms of dispersion modelling, yes.
I'm sure they came knocking, the consultants way back then came knocking on Sheffield's door, because I think we were, or you were, way ahead of the game in terms of monitoring. So they probably realised they needed a lot of good quality monitored data to be able to build a good model.
That is correct. Sheffield has always been, you know, amongst the top when it comes to air pollution monitoring. Anyway, it's been the case.
It was because of you, Ogo. Don't be so humble.
Well, it's a combination. There are people before me as well.
It's a tremendous achievement, really, and it's still ongoing. It's still AirVIRO for Sheffield, even though you're not there anymore.
It is still ongoing. But across the UK, there are other, you know, methods as well, you know, dispersion models. There's one called ADMS, developed by Cambridge University, Advanced Dispersion Modeling System. It's widely used in the UK. There's also AirMod, which is a US AirMod, AERMOD, which is a U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, you know, model. They developed it, you know. And there are several others. Now, the most basic air dispersion model is called the Gauss, the Gaussian plume. That's very simple.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it basically assumes, you know, that you have a smooth dispersion of air pollutants when they emit into the air. But we know that's not the case. So, take example, if you burn wood, or if you burn something outside and it produces smoke, if you think about it, that smoke does not remain there. It disperses.
It does.
And the reason it disperses includes the fact that there are some characteristics that impact on that smoke. Wind speed, wind direction, temperature, the pressure of the atmosphere. You know, these quantities affect, but also whether there are, you know, buildings in the pathway of dispersion and so forth. These quantities and qualities affect how that smoke disperses downwind.
Yeah.
When you say downwind, it means that the wind is affecting it in some way or the other. Excuse me. So, to be able to then predict what happens an hour later, you can either place monitors downwind or around, if you like, you know, a circumference around the source of smoke, to do that measurement, or you can use computer modeling to include data from, you know, wind speed and direction and temperature and all that, and then the modeling will help you determine, you know, what you would reasonably expect to see or to get if you monitored at, say, 100 meters down the road from where that source is coming. So that's what dispersion modeling tries to do. It tries to simulate what you're likely to expect when emissions hit the atmosphere. Now, the sources we're talking about are from road transport, from industrial activities, from home, combustion systems, and so forth. So when these emissions, that means, well, go back one step. That means that for your model, you have to provide it data.
A lot of it.
A lot of data. You have to provide it road, what's it called? The number of vehicles.
Yeah, traffic and the split of the traffic as well, because different vehicles.
And also in terms of the days, you know, when is it most busy, less busy? You provide all that information. You have to link your model to a meteorological station. They'll provide you data on wind speed, wind direction. If it's quite sophisticated and developed, it will give you pressure, atmospheric pressure, that is, cloud cover, all of that. Model draws data from, you know, those sources. In terms of industrial emissions, you will need to feed in data about chimney heights, emissions from those chimneys, at what rate are emissions occurring in terms of either smoke or, you know, particle emissions or, you know, gaseous emissions. You also need to know the diameters, of the chimney, as well as the height, as I've already indicated. So a lot of information feeds into the model, and then the model then, when you run it, okay. The other additional thing as well is topography.
Yeah, you know, hills, vales, particularly hills. Sheffield's. It's got complicated. Geography. I always remember, you know, you always said Tinsley, you know, because it's in a valley, you've got the motorway. If the wind, you know, it depends on the wind, that's why Tinsley was a problem area, I guess.
Tinsley is, you know, historically has always been an industrial area, and the motorway runs through there as well. So all of the information that feeds into the computer model is then used to predict what you're likely to get, you know, a year down the road, or even now,
even years ahead. Can I just ask, where can you recall where Sheffield gets its meteorological data from? Is it? It's not Western Park, is it?
No, we get our data from Woodburn Road. Yes, the council owns its own meteorological station.
I remember this now,
Yes, and it is a very advanced meteorological station. It actually was only established just before I left, you know, about...
I remember, I remember you working with about that, trying to get that, because it's an important part of it, weather, isn't it?
It's very important. Without that, it'd be difficult to know what's happening, and we have to give kudos to University of Sheffield, you know, for helping us.
Yay! Good old University of Sheffield. You said never trust professors or animals. Don't work with them, you said. Academics. But no, good old University of Sheffield, because we always work very closely with them. But going back to the chimney height and the width, I know the answer to this because you told me, but it's something I wouldn't even have thought about. Why does it matter? How high the chimney is and how wide it is.
Right. The higher you get, apart from temperature getting cooler, you also get less disturbance, you know, in terms of wind speed.
Yeah, because you're emitting higher up, aren't you?
Yeah.
Which I never, you know, until you told me that, I wouldn't have even, it never would have crossed my mind.
Yeah. And when emission takes place at very high up, say about 70 meters, by the time it drops to the ground, it has, the concentration of pollutant has diluted. You see, so that's why, because if you think about it, if your next door neighbor is pushing out smoke at your building height level, you'll know about it.
Yeah.
But if they build a chimney that's 30 meters up, you probably will notice.
Yeah, planning might have something to say about it, but is that why the incinerator, there's a big tower near Meadow Hall, is it Eon? It's really tall tower.
That's correct, yes.
Is that why it's so tall then?
It is, because that tower is about 90 metres high or 95 metres high, one of the two.
Wow. So I think I remember you working on planning applications. Where
that's
companies
right.
wanted, you know, we want this chimney, we're going to be burning X, Y, and Z, and you'd want to know the height of the chimney and all this, because you would use that model then, wouldn't you, to forecast what the impact would be on that particular area.
That's correct. That is correct.
It's fascinating stuff. I just don't know how they manage without you, I'll go, to be honest.
Well, I think the officer who's there now is pretty good.
But I think the foundations were strong there with the modelling software. So, you know, I know the answer to this. Air quality modelling, you use it, you know, I've said, for planning applications, but it also came absolutely into its own when we were looking at low emission zones. We were doing research into that for Sheffield, and indeed Rotherham as well. And of course, the clean air zone that's now in, it was fundamental to that process, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It was very central, you know, to understanding how we can manage air pollution in Sheffield based on the requirements, you know, of government. So it was air pollution modelling that helped tell us, you know, where the highest levels of pollution concentration is, but also if there are interventions, what effect
would
those
they have?
Interventions will have.
Yeah.
And the other thing as well is, so if you control a certain region, such as the clean air zone we have now, how would it affect other parts of the city?
Yeah.
How would it benefit other parts of the city? Dispersion modeling enabled us to be able to understand that, and therefore working with the government, DEFRA, Department for the Environment, Food and Rural Environment.
Food and Rural Affairs and DFT, old Department for Transport.
Yeah, and the Finance Department as well, Finance Ministry.
Yeah.
And working with them, they eventually agreed with our, you know, studies and evidence we provided, and then the political decisions were made and approved.
Yeah. So, but the fundamental thing about, we were lucky that we had very good transport models, and I think that's how we first got to know each other. Because
that's
I was
correct.
Dealing with the transport models and you were dealing with the air quality.
And
so basically for that process, for people who don't know about the clean air zone process, we were forecasting into the future in the transport model and saying vehicles will over time get cleaner and there'll be land use changes and the roads may change in 5, 10, 15 years. And we were putting all these into transport models, getting forecasts of the traffic flowing across the whole of Sheffield and indeed Rotherham. And then you'd put that into your air quality model and say, well, if that's the case, where do we have a problem in the future? And that's how we did it, isn't it?
Yes, and we have to give you absolute credit for your genius.
Who,
work
me?
In that transport model. Look, if you handled it so well that life was easy for us.
Oh, if only, if only. But it's all about with modelling.
As well.
Yeah, with modelling, the inputs, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out. It's the quality of those inputs, because nobody can forecast the future, can they, really?
No.
You just do your best to have a look at it. But it's a fascinating subject, and it belies the amount of work and years and years and years of work it took to get us from an air quality management area, which says you've got a problem with nitrogen dioxide gas and particulate matter. It's particularly nitrogen dioxide gas, isn't it?
Yes,
to take that from...
It's not just for Sheffield, it's everywhere else.
Yeah, it's not just us, but it takes a lot to get you from designating we've got a problem, which is an air quality management area, to doing all that research into low emission zones, what might work, and to actually translating that into reality. It's fascinating. Do you miss it or go? Do you ever miss it?
I do, but
not the stress.
Life happens, so you carry on.
You said you wouldn't leave until that clean air zone was in, yes. And you didn't.
Yes,
you
indeed.
Did it.
Yeah, it was important.
But that's been an absolutely fascinating chat. Although we could talk for hours, couldn't we? Because there's so many mathematical and chemical things you could talk about, because we got into the level of split. We had to know what engine type vehicles had,
exactly,
and apply that to the traffic flow. And if anybody wants to know more, go on to the Sheffield City Council's website. Go to the Clean Air Zone, and within all that, it's all the background information.
Yes.
Fantastic
all
stuff.
Reports are there,
yeah,
as well.
With all your name on them. Yay! Brilliant. All good stuff. What a legacy to leave, eh?
Yeah, we thank. Yeah, it's great. You
it
know, it's
is. Because you always say, hell, you know, air quality, air pollution is all about health. It affects people's health, and
yeah,
it's not good. And
protecting health.
The fact that we can't see it is another matter. Amazing stuff, Ogo. We're going to hope you're going to come back next
thank
month
you.
And talk about, well, we'll find you something exciting to talk about.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. Have a
thank
good weekend, Ogo. Bye bye. Bye.
Thank you. Bye bye. Bye bye.
I've been waiting for this moment for all.